This is Mary Flynn. I'm in Sewanee, Tennessee, talking to Romulus Lenny, to whom we are most grateful for having Fugue in Blackbird. You've turned your hand in novels, plays, and stories, and all to me seem to show a very finely tuned ear to the voices of the characters, something that would seem pretty necessary to a playwright. Is there a particular reason that plays always attracted you more than the other narratives? And do you think that the sound of voices is a particular kind of music that you enjoy making?
Yeah, no doubt, Mary. It was an evolution. I was an actor first, so that ear was very much developed. And I went to the Yale Drama School and as an actor, and then I got drafted into the Army, and something changed, and I came back and became a director. And when I directed my thesis production for a degree, I had to admit I was trying to make the play look like I wrote it. So I came into New York, but I was scared of writing plays. I never thought I could do anything like that. So I wrote fiction. And after a terrible start, I was an awful writer. I did get better, and I was lucky enough to get into a workshop run by Hiram Hayden. And he published the novel that I was working on. And
which one was
Eden
that?
Eden Valley. Mm-hmm. So then I wrote another novel, and then a play. And then later I wrote a third novel, but I've cannibalized all the novels into plays, so.
Eden Valley is one of my favorite of your plays, is it?
Yes, the play that I made out of the novel, I think in many ways, is superior to the novel, but the evolution was obvious. Eden Valley was a fairly densely written, with a lot of description, so on, of a something that happened in the Appalachian Mountains in the 1840s. The second novel was A Woman's Diary, which is really like a long aria, actually, and an almost illiterate woman keeping a diary, teaching herself to write while she has all sorts of troubles at home, to put it mildly. Then the third book was really a book of short stories, all connected.
Jesus Tales?
Yeah, all very much connected. So it was pretty much a normal progression, I think. Once the first play got done at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, in the first season of the Mark Taper Forum, it was very successful there. So, yeah, then I was on my way.
I can hear the voices of the different characters so clearly.
Sure. Every playwright, you do that. You have an ear for voice, you don't. But when you write dialogue, you're trying to make it spontaneous and interesting and this, that, and the other, but you also must move the story forward, or move the play, the situations forward. So it's not just ear. There's a lot of demand put on you because you can't indulge yourself. You got to cut everything that does not move. So that was all good. And in the last few years, I was never able to write short stories. I don't know why, but I've been trying to do that, and I write one-act plays quite well, but now I'm trying to do stories.
Now, and you've done adaptations like A Lesson Before Dying and Unchanging Love, as mm-hmm. well as the plays that have come, like Eden Valley. And with A Lesson Before Dying and Unchanging Love, one of them is pretty faithful to the novel, A Lesson
right.
Before Dying. And then Unchanging Love takes pretty strong liberties with where Chekhov
right.
set his story, and you
right.
put it in Appalachia. And how do you decide what
you're
going to do with
well,
that?
Well, I have a way of looking at that. I think that when you do an adaptation for the theater, that it's either a marriage or a love affair. If it's a marriage, you're faithful. There's a contract, and you make certain agreements between yourself and the work. And you realize that you're going to stay very strictly within limits, and you're going to do all of this. And so tremendous is my esteem and affection of many years for Ernest Gaines. There was no question but that I would be a very faithful adapter, and which I did do. The Chekhov story, In the Ravine or In the Ditch or whatever you want to call it, according to the translation, is a very famous, longish story of Chekhov's, one of his best. And here, because it didn't have any dramatic shape to it to put on the stage, but what it did have was that the Russian far country, wherever that Chekhov was writing about, was very much like Appalachia in around the turn of the century. The people and the towns and all of that, very much the same. So that I thought was good. And the central story I kept quite well. Mm-hmm. It's very faithful, it's the central story. But then what I added to give it a kind of a lift, to make it theatrical, was the idea that there's a family of folk singers involved in this, so they sing folk songs throughout. Otherwise, it's not that far off, but it is a love affair. In other words, mm-hmm. I did say, I love this story, I think the world of it. Nobody respects Chekhov more than I, but I really do believe that if Chekhov was looking at me, he would say, well, you if you want to do this, you know, do it in your own terms.
No, because there's a central truth to what you're doing to the story there that is equal to the truth that you paid to Ernest Gaines.
In a way, but it's more like you're in love in marriage and you're in love in a love affair. Mm-hmm. But in a love affair, a lot of crazy things happen, you know. So I think we take advantage of that.
And thinking of the unchanging love and the fact that you do set that in the Appalachian Mountains, and I know your family is from around Boone. I think there's a Lenny Mountain down there.
There used to be a Tater Hill that was owned by my great-grandfather, mm-hmm. whole top of a mountain, which has all sorts of stories connected to it. He would live there in the summertime in his later years. Yeah, my father's family, actually my great-uncle's family owned the house there. But my father was always welcome, and his father was always welcome. Mm-hmm. And during the Depression, my father went back to Boone, and I lived 4 years of my early life in Boone. So the voices, I think that in my plays, the Appalachian plays, the pitch of the voices is a little sharper. You know, the other plays are okay at their best, but the pitch of the voices is a little sharper. Because I heard that when I was a child.
Mm-hmm. And there does seem to me to be a tremendous affection in, say, the end of Heathen Valley for that landscape and place.
You never forget that, you know, as a child. I mean, to me, the mountains are always mysterious and beautiful and full of a lot of very deep feeling. My father died when I was 13, and I missed him all my life. And he loved the mountains. He just waited for the summer when he could leave his practice and for 2 weeks or 3 weeks go up into the mountains and fish and hunt. And I never became much of a hunter or fisher, though I tried a little bit. But I remember him, and it's through his love of the mountains, really, that I...
So in a way, when you're writing about the Appalachian Mountains, that's in a way of writing for your father.
I wish he was alive to read it.
Lee Smith's father said he always liked to have a mountain to lay his eyes on.
No, sure. Well, people who live in the mountains, you know, they get sick when they leave. I mean, were you up there? I mean, I don't know now because it's so... Boone is like Woodstock now, but in the 30s, I know people would get sick when they have to go off the mountain. They didn't want to. The water was never right. This was never right. That was never right. They were never happy until they got back.
Now, being down here in Sewanee, being up on this mountain always reminds me of being up in my mountains up in Wythville. Does it remind you of, and you have traveled. You've gone out from here and gone back to Boone or that area.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I'm very familiar with all this. In fact, I went back one Sunday early on when I was teaching here. I went back to Madison, Tennessee, where we lived after Boone, and I found the house that we lived in, which is in many ways connected to the sadness of my father's death and so on. And whoever lives there takes wonderful care of the house. It's in grand shape. It's in a lovely little neighborhood, and I drove around it 3 or 4 times, took pictures of it, and thought, well, that's very nice. That's really good. Great. Fine. This is terrific. And then I found myself parking in a McDonald's parking lot and sobbing for 15 minutes, you know. So...
You and Charles Wright are two interesting writers to me who've gone far afield from either Kingsport or Boone, and yet the Appalachian Mountains still turn up in your work with some regularity.
Well, the great thing about the Appalachian Mountains is that they are about the oldest things on the earth. It's Precambrian sandstone, I think. And there is a sense of enormous age. And as permanent as anything is, and it's really quite wonderful. That's why the Scottish, when they saw the mountains, they said this is home, because it's very much like the mountains of Scotland.
And they brought their songs and their stories with
them. They sure did.
But also time seems to me somewhat permeable in many of your plays. They remind me of Dreamtime in terms of the structure of sort of living in several moments simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Are you attracted to time in particular as a way to tell your stories?
I don't think about it. The play that I'm working on now is a play about the poet Delmore Schwartz. And he has a wonderful poem called Calmly We Walk Through This April Day. And the last lines are, time is the school in which we learn. Time is the fire in which we burn. Famous quote. But I really like that. And I think that somehow has a lot. I think that it's very important. A wonderful photographer, Jill Crimmins, in New York, wrote a wonderful book in which she took pictures of children whose parents had died when they were at an early age and wrote, you know, just took down some of their feelings. And it's a marvelous book. And I think that when that happens to you at a very early age, you have a very deep rock-bottom sense of loss and permanence and how one affects the other. And I think that's pretty much throughout the work. And if that's what you mean by time, or a feeling of time, I think that would certainly be true.
Mm-hmm. Shades of other playwrights seem to kind of hover behind some of your plays. I'm thinking April Snow has some of the wit of Noel Coward, and Chow Byron, to me, has a little feel of Strindberg in it from time to time. But who were your favorite of the playwrights that you read from the past, and who are some young people who are writing good plays now that you might recommend?
Well, doing the first, I think the most interesting playwright in New York right now is Donald Margulies, whose play Dinner with Friends won the Pulitzer Prize. Of course, Edward Albee is having a great resurgence of his powers, which are marvelous. There are many, many, many fine people. But I'm very partial to Donald because I, at Sundance back in the 80s, I heard a reading of a play of his, which unfortunately, according to, you know, theatrical chance, was not successful, but I think it's, and he agreed, it's an absolutely marvelous, wonderful play. It's called What's Wrong with This Picture? And I have been a great fan, we're friends, and I've been a great fan of his ever since. So I put him sort of as the guy who's going to do, who's already done wonderful things, who's going to continue. He's in mid-career, and he's going to do all sorts of wonderful things. As far as influences, well, Faulkner, of course. You can't be Southern, I don't think, and not be tremendously indebted to him. I mean, he just did so much for me. I had little sense of my Southern background. I went to Oberlin College. I wanted to get as far away from the South as I could. I went to Oberlin College, and a lot of things about the South I didn't like. But that was it, you know, and I sort of, he showed me what my youth and childhood had really been. I only read Faulkner at the end of my senior year. I just picked up a used book and read The Bear with astonishment, you know, so then I read everything. And that was one of my problems, because when I stopped being an actor and a director and tried to write, I was writing this, you know, fantastically Loggerian, Faulknerian, diarrhea kind of prose. And another writer whom I really liked very much was a Swedish writer I found named Per Lagerkvist. And Lagerkvist had a steely, controlled kind of prose, and that helped me a lot. I liked what he wrote, and I liked the way he wrote it, and it was something quite different, and it really sort of helped me control things a little more.
Fascinates me what you have to do in a play to keep things moving, because the dialogue does have to serve so many purposes.
One of the big things that you have difficulty when you teach playwriting is to make young students understand that it does, you can't do that. Plays aren't arguments, they're not essays, they're not, you know, no matter how eloquent or witty or all that stuff, an audience wants an event. It doesn't have to be linear, it doesn't have to be sequential, it can be any kind of an event, but they want something to happen up there, and they want whatever is happening to have something to do with them. Mm-hmm. And you better learn that as a playwright, because if you don't, you're in trouble.
Something that has interested me in your work, too, is that you've taken historical situations like Frederick the Great or two about Goering and explored things that way. The Goering play, where did that come from?
I'm not quite sure, but it came from mainly from my reading the transcript of the Nuremberg trials. Goering was on the stand for 8 days, and the transcript is a novel length. And when I read it, I read Scheirer and this, that, and the other, and I was, of course, quite aware of the war. I was a boy, but I quite knew what was happening. But Goering's testimony was astonishing as I read it, because there it was, unvarnished. That's what happened. That's what was said, and not changed. It was real. And he behaved very well up until the end. Finally, they caught him. He was doing all sorts of stuff, of course, but he was witty. He was brave. He would not hide behind Hitler, as Speer did, and so on. And I thought, well, is this the horrible Hermann Goering? And of course it was, and that was what interested me, that kind of ambivalence in this man who was so terribly destructive. Because very possible that had Hitler not enlisted Goering in the early days of his little beer hall party, it would never have come to prominence, because he was a war hero and all of that. So I tried to write a play in which you cannot help but sympathize a little bit with this man fighting for his life and doing it well. And then, of course, you, at the same time, have a thing where I have him center stage and put a film on top of him against the white walls at the back of the set, which are the horrors of the Holocaust. So, you know, and that really, that really screws an audience up, which is what I wanted to do. At the premiere at the Actors Theater of Louisville, when the play was over, oh, maybe two-thirds of the audience was on its feet clapping and cheering, and another third was sitting there in stony fury, furious at the play for doing that, you know, because Goering is supposed to be this. So I think that there was, I haven't located it yet, and it takes years later you look back. I know about Frederick and Byron, where they came from, and usually something tremendously deep in your subconscious or in your past life intersects with something that happens today or yesterday, and they set each other off, and the real creative fuel, or whatever, to sound pretentious, but comes from this deep subconscious forgotten thing that really does get to you, and then the thing that has happened today gives you the form of this or that and the other and so forth. So it's very interesting. I love to do historical work. But I can't do anything unless this mysterious process, it's got to somehow reach me in some way that I only realize much later. Frederick is about a father and a son, basically. Byron is about a father and a daughter. But A Woman Without a Name, which is the play from a novel, Slowly by the Hand Unfurled, which I think probably is the best writing I'll ever do, is about one aspect of my mother, you know. So I found an old diary. Started reading it, and the next thing I knew, I was tearing this novel out. It came out sort of hot from the oven. And it was only years later I said, oh my God, you know, these great, huge, bong-bonging carillon cliches that come clanging down. You say, my God. But you'd better have something like that working when you're writing, because otherwise you're writing intellectual, you know, ideas or stuff like that, which none of which is interesting.
The relationship between Byron and Ada and Child Byron is deeply affecting.
Well, my wonderful daughter, who has a marvelous career as an actress, whom I admire both as an artist and as a woman, her mother and I were divorced when she was about a year when I could not see her. She was down in Georgia, but then she moved back to New York. And so, but I wrote the play, I started to write the play as a historical play about Byron, and then I discovered these marvelous lines in Childe Harold where Byron writes to the daughter he cannot see, who's in England and he's in Europe, in exile. And so the play on the surface is a play about Byron, but underneath it's very subtextually about myself and my wonderful daughter. In her final year at Brown University, she acted in all the plays, and at the end of the year they did the play and she played the part.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was some experience. When people say, well, you're going to do a play with your daughters, you're going to do a play of yours, and I say, we've already done that.